The Fed's talking about taking a pause or possibly inserting a break in its rate hikes. Meanwhile, inflation's still at 5%, and Uncle Sam is spending like there's no tomorrow. I'm Graham Summers, and this is Bulls, Bears, and BS. Welcome back to Bulls, Bears, and BS. I'm Graham Summers, and today is Monday, June 5th, 2023. I'd like to start this week's episode by talking about being wrong. If you're serious about getting into investing or making money from the markets, you're going to have to get used to being wrong. The reality is the greatest traders alive only have a win rate of about 60%. So that means these guys who are professionals and the best of the business are wrong 40% of the time. And when they're wrong, it means that they lose money. And as I've been telling clients for many years, if you don't want to lose any money, don't go into investing. Going into investing and expecting not to lose money is like going into boxing and expecting not to get punched in the face. It's just part of the deal. The thing that's most important is to engage in risk management in such a way that when you are wrong and you lose money, you only lose a little bit. And you never suffer a catastrophic loss. Provided that when you're wrong, you only lose a little money and you never suffer a catastrophic loss, then over the long term, you will accrue wealth from the markets. This is how most traders and professional money managers who succeed think about these things. They don't approach a situation from the perspective of how much money am I about to make. They approach it from what's the maximum amount I could lose if I'm proven to be spectacularly wrong. And again, the reason they do this is because 40% of the time they're likely to be wrong. I bring all of this up because it's looking a little bit as if I'm wrong on the stock market. I have been bearish on stocks for most of this year. And despite that, and despite all the data points, the economic trends, everything that I've noted on this podcast, the stock market simply refuses to break down. Now, at the end of the day, you can bang your head against the wall and say, well, wait a minute, we have the yield curve inversion. We have all the revisions in the jobs data. We have the weak GDP. We have the fact that inflation's 5%. You could say all that stuff. But at the end of the day, if the stock market's refusing to break down, you ultimately end up wrong. So the question I've been asking myself is, am I wrong on this? And the stock market is suggesting I might be. The 200-day moving average for the most major indices has begun to curl upward, which indicates that the trend is going to be upwards in the intermediate term. This is no longer a short-term issue. This is now intermediate. Remember, we're talking about the 200-day moving average. That's the average of the previous 200 days closing prices. The fact that it's turning up means the trend is shifting. It suggests that the bear market is at a minimum experiencing a significant pause. And it also, or it could be suggesting that the bear market's over and a new bull market is beginning. And this is something I have to consider, regardless of my views, regardless of my analysis, regardless of the data, I have to look at what the market's telling me. So I've been thinking a lot, what is it I could be wrong about? Inflation's at 5%. That's a big negative for the lower 80% of this country. It is a positive for the upper 20% because they're earning 5% now on their cash, which provides them with extraordinary amounts of discretionary spending without them having to touch their actual investments. It also is presenting itself in the form of asset price inflation, namely stocks, real estate, and other items are going up. So what's the deal? Well, the reality is this is a very complicated situation today in the economy and in the financial system, and it's being complicated greatly by the federal government. The Fed is trying to end inflation, at least that's what it's arguing, and to that end, it's raised rates from 0.25% to 5.25%, and it's drained about $500 billion in liquidity from the financial system via quantitative tightening. However, over that same time period, the federal government has been spending an exorbitant amount of money that is somewhat negating the Fed's attempts. The United States' budget works as follows. The government spends money, and it takes in money via tax revenues. And if tax revenues are not adequate to cover the cost of the spending, then it's in a deficit, and it finances that deficit by issuing debt. Well, the United States government is currently running a $1.2 trillion deficit, which means it's spending $1.2 trillion more than it takes in via taxes. And this is while it's recording record amounts of tax intakes. I believe it took in $4 trillion in taxes so far for the year 2022. So you're talking about some $6 trillion in spending. And in fact, I believe the current government outlays for fiscal year 2023 is something like $6.3 trillion in spending. Well, $6.3 trillion in spending comes to about 23% of GDP. So you can say that the government is effectively spending 23% of GDP this year. On top of this, the new debt ceiling deal actually doesn't put a cap on spending at all. I talked about this a little bit last week, but the reality is there's a clause in the spending deal that states that the Office of Management and Budget Director has sole waiver authority on any spending caps, provided she believes that the spending is necessary to deliver programs as they are described. What that essentially means in government lingo is that the director of the Office of Management and Budget, which is a part of the executive branch, and it's in charge of financing and spending money in a way that meets the president's vision, has the ability to waive any and all spending cuts, provided she believes, because it's a woman who's the current director, that the spending is necessary to deliver on the programs as set out by the president. So essentially, for all of the hand-wringing and talks of debt crisis and talks of a default, the reality is the debt deal in its current status, which has now been signed into law, gives almost dictatorial powers to the Office of Management and Budget Director to deliver spending in any way she sees fit, provided it's needed for the programs that the executive branch has laid out. So what I'm saying here is that while the Federal Reserve is trying to end inflation and is tightening monetary conditions, on the fiscal side, the government is spending money as if we're still in an emergency. And in fact, this debt deal that was just signed essentially normalizes the emergency level of spending that was first installed during the COVID-19 pandemic. What it effectively is doing is saying, this is now normal for us. We now run $1+ trillion deficits every year, even if the economy is growing. And the economy is growing, albeit at a low rate. I believe this is why the stock market is refusing to break down. I also believe it's a big reason why inflation is proving to be so sticky. And when you add into all of this the fact that the Fed is now talking about possibly skipping hiking rates or even potentially introducing a rate hike pause when inflation's at 5% and the government's spending money like this, then you've got yourself a situation in which there's going to be just a massive spending splurge going into the presidential and congressional elections of 2024. What I'm essentially saying is, even if the Fed's trying to tighten monetary conditions, and this should be a negative for the stock market, the fact that the federal government is funneling so much money into the economy and financial system is negating the Fed's efforts. And if the Fed is serious about potentially slowing the pace of its rate hikes or even pausing, then God help us, because inflation's still at 5%, and all of this is taking place when the economy's still growing. Now, this is more intermediate term in terms of the next, say, 6 to 18 months going into the election of 2024. In the very near term, it's quite possible that we're going to see risk assets take it on the chin. The reason for that is that if you go back to what I said a few minutes ago, the federal government has to issue debt to cover the deficit. And now that the debt deal has been signed, we're about to see the government issue a massive amount of debt. I believe it's $400 or $500 billion in the next 30 days alone, and something like $1.3 trillion by January. And that is going to involve a lot of liquidity leaving the financial system, because whoever goes to buy that debt, they're taking their money either out of the bank or they're taking their money out of the reverse repo arrangement that they have with the Fed. All of that's actually pretty complicated, so let me try and break this down in very simple terms. Currently, financial institutions and banks are parking something like $2 trillion with the Fed every night. The reason they're doing this is because the Fed pays them over 5% interest on the money they park there overnight. Now, it's not 5% per night, it's 5% on an annualized basis. But the point is, the banks have all this excess funds lying around, and so they're parking them with the Fed, and they're getting paid 5% plus in interest on it. So you've got that amount of money sloshing around, which tells us there's too much money in the financial system. And then you've also got money sitting in bank deposits. And this is the money that's going to be used to buy all the debt that the Treasury has to issue in the coming weeks. So the question is, does the money come from either people or corporations pulling their money out of bank deposits and then buying the debt? Or does it come from banks and financial institutions deciding not to park their money with the Fed, but instead use it to buy T-bills or short-term treasuries? Regardless, liquidity is going to have to leave the financial system to buy those bonds. So my point with what I'm saying is, in the very near term, specifically the next 30 days, and definitely going in towards the end of the year, we're going to see a lot of liquidity come out of the financial system, which might be a big negative for risk assets like stocks. But over and above this, the government is spending so much money, and it's doing this at a time when the economy is still growing. And it's also doing this at a time when the Fed is potentially pausing on its rate hikes while inflation is still 5%. We could find ourselves in a situation in which the stock market simply refuses to drop and in fact continues to rally. Now, I'm not saying that this is going to be some explosive move higher to new all-time highs, but it's definitely more likely than not at this point that stocks will continue to hold up for some time, and the next leg down will only really truly hit when there's a recession. And the odds of a recession hitting this year when the government's spending this kind of money and inflation's still at 5%, but consumers still have excess savings, is looking less and less. This is probably what the stock market is seeing, that the odds of a recession are actually pretty low this year. If a recession hits at all, it will be in 2024. And the government is spending so much money that it's simply overriding any monetary tightening that the Federal Reserve has done. Then we throw in the fact that the Fed now believes it needs to pause or take a break from rate hikes because it's done so much in the last 12 months. Well, what do you think that's going to do to risk assets? So how do we confirm this hypothesis? How do we confirm that this is going to happen and the stock market's going to continue to go up? Well, for that to happen, we need to see more participation in the stock market. As I've noted previously, most of this rally in stocks has been driven by about 10 companies total, the large tech companies, Meta, Alphabet, Apple, Microsoft, etc. 480 stocks out of the S&P 500's 500 companies have not been participating in this rally thus far. The big question now is, how does this divergence resolve? Do tech companies kind of just tread water and all of the laggards start catching up, which means that market breadth would dramatically improve? If that happens, then yeah, we're going to see stocks go much, much higher, possibly to 4,300 and change on the S&P 500. The other situation could be simply that the large tech stocks roll over and collapse, and everything else sort of treads water or goes up a little bit, and the market just sort of moves sideways. In order for us to get a real full-fledged collapse at this point, we would need the lagging companies and the lagging sectors to continue to drop, and then the large tech companies to crash or collapse in a major way. It's not looking like that's going to be the case. You have to simply look at what price action is telling you, and every dip in the stock market is being bought. And in fact, we saw hints of a rotation take place on Friday in which many of the lagging stock sectors and stock companies caught a bid. So perhaps what's going to happen is all those lagging sectors and companies are finally going to start participating in this rally, and the stock market will continue to go up. Now, I'm not saying this is the beginning of some new major bull market where we will see stocks going to new all-time highs. It's much too early to assess that. I'm also not saying that stocks are just going to go straight up from now on without any pullbacks. Every bull market or bear market rally sees significant pullbacks during the course of its duration. But what I am saying is that if you look at the 200-day moving average for the primary indices, and you look at all the money the government is spending, and you look at the fact that price action is telling us that dips are being bought and that selling pressure is never really overriding the bulls, then this suggests the pain trade is up and we continue to see stocks rising, which suggests that we should see some of the lagging sectors like healthcare or industrials or energy start rallying and participating in this bear market rally or potential bull market. So what would this mean as far as my forecast? Well, it would mean that I was wrong. it would mean that my bearish views were proven false and that the stock market bottomed in a significant way in October of 2022. That's fine with me. I've never once argued that I'm always right. And in fact, no one's always right in this business. As I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, the greatest traders alive are only right 60% of the time, which means 40% they're dead wrong. Warren Buffett, George Soros, Stanley Druckenmiller, all of these guys have been wrong many, many times in their careers. And in fact, they've all lost hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars being wrong. The reason they became investing legends and accrued such massive wealth is because they were very careful with risk management in terms of being wrong. And that's exactly what I did regarding the stock market rally. My view was that if the market had not actually fully bottomed in October of 2022, we would see another major leg down begin, and that would see stocks going to new lows. Based on the math, if we had a recession hit, this would mean a 25% drop in earnings per share, which would mean that the S&P 500, based on its forward trading multiple of 16 to 18 times forward earnings, would drop somewhere down to the mid to upper 2000s. That would be quite a loss of capital for anybody who bought in October or who bought during any of the dips subsequent to October 2022. And so from a risk management perspective, the framework being used was, it's better to miss out on some initial gains after a market bottom than to risk losing a massive amount of capital if the market has not in fact bottomed and new lows are coming. So this was the framework we were using after October of 2022 up until about a few weeks ago. So what all changed that made me decide to change my forecast and look at things differently? Well, price action, the fact that stocks just simply refused to break down and digested so much negative news without any difficulty. And second of all, the fact that the 200-day moving average have started curling upwards. This is a sign that the intermediate trend is looking to be upwards, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast. And this was the signal I was waiting for to either prove or disprove my thesis that we had new lows coming sometime the first half of this year. The fact that the 200-day moving average has turned like this and stocks are refusing to break down and dips are being bought tells me I was wrong, and it tells me that it's now probably a good idea to start putting some capital into the stock market. So that's what we're going to be urging our clients to do. Now, we're not saying move a massive amount of capital to work here. We're simply saying it's time to start shifting some allocation of capital back into stocks with the idea that some kind of significant bottom is in place and that we're potentially going to see this rally last longer than anyone expects. Now, I realize this is very taboo for my industry. Most of the gurus or analysts or people who write investment research like to pretend that their win rate's 100%. They're never wrong. They never miss a market turn. They always are flawless. And that's just total BS. And that's not the way I do things. I'm very upfront when I'm wrong. I'm telling you right now in a public podcast that it looks as though I was totally wrong as far as the market's concerned starting in October of 2022. And that brings me back to my initial point from this podcast. If you're actually serious about investing, you're going to be wrong, and you're going to be wrong quite a bit. It's a very weird industry. It's not like dentistry or plumbing where you get things wrong here and there. Again, the greatest living traders in the world are only right 60% of the time. So investing as a profession means 40% of the time you're going to be wrong, and that's if you're one of the best in the business. So again, this is a very humbling industry to work in. It's one in which you're frequently wrong, and it's one in which being wrong means losing money. The question is, how do you do it? Missing out on a rally, that's, you know, you're missing out on making some money, but you're not actually losing money. Compare that to being fully invested. When a recession hits or the stock market has to drop an additional 20 to 30%, that's a very big deal. There's a reason why people who are successful at managing funds or trading think in those terms. The reason for that is that mathematically, your trading has to improve dramatically when you suffer a major loss. Think of it this way. If you lose 25% on an investment, you now need to make a 33% gain just to be back to break even. If you lose 50% on an investment, you have to now double your returns in order to get back to break even, and so on and so forth. So the critical thing is to make sure that when you're wrong, you don't lose that much money. That typically means cutting losses when they're relatively small or once they completely defy your initial investment thesis, because that's the other component with investing. You can sometimes be correct about something, but the move doesn't happen in the time frame in which you think. The question is the underlying asset that you're invested in simply chopping sideways, or is it moving in a way that negates your initial thesis? It's perfectly fine to sit on an investment, even if it's a loss, provided the loss isn't negating the basis of the investment in the first place. So let's say you're down 10% on something, but it's just sort of trading sideways, and that 10% loss is a normal price action move for that particular security. That's not a huge deal. But if you're invested in, say, a security that traditionally doesn't move more than, say, 5% in a week, and you're now down 30%, and it's extremely unlikely it's suddenly going to come back and make all that money back for you. In situations such as that, the smart thing to do is to simply cut the loss, move on to the next investment, because it's gone from being highly probable to highly improbable it works out. So again, this podcast has been a little bit different today because we've been talking about being wrong, but that's sort of the purpose of Bulls, Bears, and BS to begin with. We're trying to honestly assess the markets, honestly present how things work, and honestly think about how the markets work and how to invest in them. So where do we go from here in terms of the markets? Well, tech is extraordinarily overbought, and it's been the primary leader. In fact, I believe 7 companies alone have accounted for all of the market's gains this year. So I wouldn't be surprised to see tech kind of chop sideways or possibly do a retracement through which it gives up some of its recent gains. The big question is if some of these lagging sectors start to play catch up. The ones I'm watching in particular are healthcare and industrials. Their symbols are XLV as in Victor and XLI as in Igloo. Those are ones that have been sort of moving sideways as opposed to correcting or dropping. So if they start to rally here, we'll get additional thrust in terms of breadth moving upwards. That would overall be positive for the markets and would alleviate some of the pressure we're seeing outside of tech. Financials also look like they might be putting in some kind of a bottom. Their symbol is XLF. In the financial space, the regional banking ETF, the symbol is KRE. I'm looking at that for signs of whether or not the stress that we've been seeing in the regional banks has been alleviated. As I say this, they're only up to $42 a share, so there's a lot of resistance overhead at that level. However, if they catch a bid, that would be a big signal that all's clear behind the scenes in the financial system and would probably open the door to a broader, more expansive rally in stocks as a whole. Finally, I'm having a look at some of the commodities plays, mainly because if the Fed is looking to pause rate hikes or at least skip rate hikes for a little bit, then the inflation trade should catch a bid again. Because remember, inflation, according to the official data, is still around 5%. So if the Fed's suddenly deciding that it's going to stop being so aggressive with the rate hikes, then you've got the potential for the inflation trade to get a major bid. A lot of commodities plays are extremely beaten down. The peak in most commodities was March of 2022. Since that time, things like oil are down quite a lot. So I'm looking at oil, I'm looking at energy, I'm looking at copper, I'm looking at some of these plays in lithium and cobalt and things like that. Companies that are sitting on top world-class resources that are used for green energy and other things that are being driven by government spending right now. So we've covered an awful lot during this particular podcast, so let's do something of a conclusion. I started out by focusing on the fact that if you want to be involved in the markets and you want to be investing, you're going to lose money. There's nothing you can do about it. If you're only losing money 30% of the time, then you're absolutely extraordinary because most people lose money 40% or more of the time. The key between the people who succeed and the people who end up just losing over and over is that the people who succeed have systems in place to minimize their losses or to make sure that when they're spectacularly wrong, they don't lose a lot of capital, but when they're right, they do make a lot of capital. And that's really all there is that distinguishes sophisticated, successful traders from people who just lose money nonstop. Outside of that, we've assessed the fact that the government is engaged in such rampant fiscal spending that it's sort of overriding the Federal Reserve's attempt to raise and tighten monetary policy. And as a result of that, it looks as though the government's sort of dragging the economy along in a way that it's unlikely we'll get a recession this year. In terms of the stock market specifically, tech is extraordinarily overbought. It's been the driving force about stocks holding up most of this year. The majority of the S&P 500 is actually down. So if we're going to see a broader market rally that's sustained, we need to start seeing some of these lagging sectors play catch up and start supporting tech while tech potentially either consolidates or suffers some kind of retracement to cool off. That's really all I've got for you this week. I'm Graham Summers. This is Bulls, Bears, and BS.